Hey friends, this is Michael Bohm with Youth Apologetics Training. Today we're going to keep going with this series with Russ Brialt of Shroud Encounter, shroudencounter.com, and we're talking about the Shroud of Turin. As you guys can see, this is pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, again, I don't know. I don't know if that's the actual burial cloth of Christ, but it does appear like this is not a fraud, some kind of forgery, right? It doesn't seem like, and we're going to continue looking at some of the, we're going to look at some of the objections to this burial cloth as well. It doesn't appear like this thing could be faked, at least back when the shroud actually showed up on the scene. Okay. Perhaps we could recreate something like that nowadays, but I just don't see how this could have been done. Having said that, nonetheless, I'm not going to completely run off with this and proclaim it to be the actual burial cloth of Christ, but I am absolutely blown away at this shroud and the evidence, the attributes of the shroud. It's fascinating to me. So anyway, yeah, let's pick up where we left off here yesterday with Russ Brialt of Shroud Encounter. Okay, and so there's evidence of scourging, and I heard that a lot of these marks have dumbbell-shaped, shapes at the end of the whip mark.
Yeah, that would be common, at least, you know, the flagrum generally has a wooden base with two or three leather thongs coming out from it, tipped with either bits of bone or metal, from historically it appears that they mostly used the sheep knuckles. Historically they felt that because they didn't want to kill Jesus, because they could actually kill people by scourging them to death. And they wanted to scourge him up, but they didn't want him dead because they wanted to hang him on a cross, and they wanted him to live, you know, so that he could suffer on that cross. And so that they scourged him with probably a kind of a blunted lead scourge, so that it didn't break the skin. It wasn't designed to really just obliterate your skin. It was we can see the marks. Obviously, they've left marks, but again, there are different kinds of scourges, and you can have scourges that would literally pierce right down into the muscle and just tear you apart. And that appears not to be what they used on Jesus, at least according to the shroud.
Okay. And then there's a spear wound, I shouldn't say that. There is a wound in the side where this person was pierced.
Okay. Yeah, there's a wound in the side about 4 centimeters long. It appears to correspond pretty well to a Roman lance.
Okay. And then
by the way, that's an important point, is that all of the blood marks we see on the shroud occurred when the man was alive, except for the side wound. The side wound has a very clear separation of blood and blood serum flowing down from it and then flowing across the small of the back. This is post-mortem blood flow, blood that flows after death. All the other blood marks are, show that this was blood that oozed or spurted or whatever when he was alive, but not the side wound.
That's fascinating. Okay. And then there is holes in the wrist. I thought the Bible said that he was crucified through the hands.
Well, there's two schools of thought on that. Dr. Pierre Barbet, who wrote the book called The Doctor at Calvary, he did some experiments on some cadavers and found that a nail going through the palm of the hand cannot hold the weight of a crucified man. And so then he nailed it in the wrist, and lo and behold, it held. And we see the nail wound in the wrist and on the shroud. And now Dr. Fred Zugabe, another forensic pathologist, felt that if you would take the nail at the very top of the palm, at the at kind of the where it almost comes to your wrist and at an angle, that would also hold the body. And so it's either going to be at the very top of the palm or in the wrist. At either point, the exit wound is going to appear exactly where we see it on the shroud.
Okay.
And because remember, all we see is just the top of one hand. We don't see the underside. We just see the top of one hand. So we don't see the entry point of the wound. We only see the exit point of the wound. And it's now what's interesting is that again, you know, Barbe proved that the nail through the palm of, you know, right in the middle of the palm cannot hold the weight of a crucified man. And then also what they proved is that when a nail penetrates the wrist like that, it partially cuts the median nerve, and that causes the thumbs to kind of forces the thumbs into the center of the palm. And on the shroud image, you see four fingers and no thumbs. And it's so that would be also be anatomically accurate for what, you know, for the, you know, for that nail going through where it did.
Man, okay. And from what I understand, that Greek word in the Bible where it says hands, nail wounds in his hands, that Greek word can encompass anywhere from the elbow down to the fingertip.
Yeah, the word is chair, C-H-I-E-R. And you're right. It doesn't mean in the Greek just the palm of the hand.
Okay. What about this? Listening to Gary Habermas, he mentioned that the abdomen was extended, which indicated
asphyxiation. Yeah. The abdomen seems to be extended. It also seems to indicate rigor mortis as well. And it's most people who died by crucifixion, their lungs eventually filled up with pleural fluid, and just from the ordeal, and it's and eventually just die by asphyxiation. In fact, this is why the scripture tells you that when the Romans came by late in the afternoon, around 4 PM, that they broke the legs of the first man. It was, you know, the first thief, and then they broke the legs of the second. But then it says, but when they came to Jesus, they noticed that he was already dead, so therefore they did not break his legs. Now, so why would you break the legs of somebody? Well, one of the things is that they would hang from their wrists, and that would also cause asphyxia, because you could breathe in, but you couldn't breathe out. And so they would die from asphyxia and shock, and it'd be dead within about 15 minutes. And it's and then they could, you know, remove them from the cross and, generally speaking, throw them into a common grave. And but remember, now Jesus was already dead. Then in the whole scenario, Joseph of Arimathea had gone to Pontius Pilate to request to have the body delivered to him for burial. and so he permitted this, obviously. I mean, Pilate didn't care. As long as Jesus was dead, he was happy. I'm sure, I would imagine he would have dispatched a couple centurions back over there. And then that's when they pierced him in the side to make sure that he was dead before they released him to Joseph for burial.
Okay. Another thing that he mentioned is going back to the image itself and what you mentioned there about distance information being encoded. Gary Habermas said that you could actually see the teeth in this man's face.
Yeah, there seems to be a energy. One of the things that why we believe energy is involved, most likely light, is because because we can see the large hollow orbits of the eyes, we can see the evidence of teeth and the roots of teeth, we can see also in the hands. Now, it's very interesting that an article came out in Biblical Archaeological Review back in 1985, and they said, aha, the shroud is a fake because the fingers are too long. And I say usually, oh, great, so now we have a medieval artist who gets everything right except the fingers. And but maybe this is a clue that maybe we're not looking at fingers, because when you look at the skeletal structure of a hand, you will see that your hand in an X-ray, your fingers, the actual bone part of your fingers goes all the way through the palm and then connects up with your wrist. And so in the skeletal or in the X-ray, your fingers look really, really long, because half of what you're looking at is actually in the palm of your hand. And so what we see on the shroud, we think, is a combination of flesh and bone simultaneously. And that's exactly what Habermas is talking about. Now, one of the interesting theories that is promoted or come up with by Dr. John Jackson, he's a theoretical physicist, and it's called the collapse theory. Now, this is really neat because his theory is, and again, the problem is you can't replicate this in a laboratory, so it's just going to remain an untested hypothesis, is that as the body of Jesus literally converted to a volume of light, remember, light has no mass, so literally he converted to a volume of light, and for a period of, and we don't even know for how long, but the cloth began to descend through the body to the depth of about 8 millimeters, and then the body was gone. And this would explain some of the features that we see on the shroud. It would explain the large hollow orbits of the eyes, the teeth structure, the skeletal structure of the hand. Also, there are contusions on both cheeks, and the... what's interesting is that I have a medical doctor friend of mine, Dr. Gus Acetta, and he's done a lot of work on this, and he also supports this view of the collapse theory as opposed to a projected image, if you will, because his point is that a contusion didn't break the skin. It's like a very deep bruise in the face on both cheeks. Like Jesus was like beat with something, but it didn't break the skin. And so we see these contusions, and that would only be picked up if the cloth was descending through the body. And, I don't know, it's just a cool theory. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're just not gonna know. I mean, it's where we're trying to do is, you know, like I say, it's either the burrow shot of Jesus, and if that's the case, we have to look at what ostensibly happened to Jesus in the tomb and see if we can, you know, replicate any aspect of that, you know, or if it's the work of an artist and we got to figure out how the artist did it. But, you know, right now, this, you know, bear in mind that this artist must have predated Leonardo by several hundred years. He's not identified. No one knows how he did it. And so again, if we're going to allege that this is just the work of an artist, then I think the responsibility is also to show how he did it.
Right, right. What about the coins that supposedly are spotted on the eyes? Now, I looked at the pictures. I couldn't really make it out. But have you heard of this whole coins on the eyes of Christ?
Sure.
Supposedly Pontius Pilate.
There appear to be circular objects placed over the eyes, buttons, coins. There are round objects placed on the eyes. Now in excavations in Masada, we have found coins in the back of skulls. So in other words, you know, we would assume that the coin started off on the eyes to begin with. And it's, and so we, and so, you know, today a coroner would use tape to shut the eyes, to close the eyes. And back then they might have used a simple coin. Now, having said that, Dr. Francis Filas was a shroud researcher in Chicago, and he was looking only at photography taken in 1931 by Giuseppe Henri, and he was using a kind of a contrast enhanced black and white photograph or photographic plate. And so in the Henri photographs, if you magnify it, look right over the right eye under, there's the belief that there appears to be some lettering there, UCAI, which is the portion of the inscription that would have read Tiberius Caesar. And the problem with this is that it only shows up in Henri photography. It doesn't show up in other photographs of the shroud. So the question is it there or is it not there? And so I tend not to really focus on that because I just really don't know if it's really there or if it's just an anomaly of the film, you know, of that particular 1931 photography.
What about the pollen that has been found on the shroud?
Oh, there's lots of pollen on the shroud. In fact, much of the pollen is actually airborne pollen. Some of it's airborne, obviously, because pollen gets on it, but a lot of the pollen is actually from pollen that was laid onto the, from flowers that were laid onto the cloth itself. And so there, we can see that much of the pollen lies in like clusters. And Dr. Avinoam Dineen is one of the leading botanists, or has the leading botanist for the flowers of Israel. He's written 7 books on the flowers of the Holy Land. He's analyzed all that, and he is absolutely convinced that based on the pollen and based on what's also flower images that appear to be on the shroud, that this cloth originated within a 20-kilometer radius of Jerusalem. And Avinoam Dineen wrote a book called The Botany of the Shroud. And so he is absolutely convinced of that, and he's Jewish, so he's not, you know, swinging some kind of Christian axe here.
All right, I'm going to stop right there. Tomorrow, guys, we'll pick up exactly where we left off here today. And with that, I love you guys, and I'll see you tomorrow.